Good afternoon, good morning, and aloha, everybody. Welcome to the Advocacy Learning Center's bi-monthly affinity discussion. My name is Kata Isari, and I will be the moderator for today's call. We are so thrilled that we will be joined by teams from three classes today, classes F, G, and H. We're happy to have you here, and we're looking forward to a stimulating conversation. This is the first of three discussions in our affinity series that will be exploring shelter rules, an interesting and hot topic for many of us right now. As always, the affinity discussions provide a format where we can have an interactive dialogue with all of you amongst our peers and with faculty and staff and guests. We're going to encourage all of you to participate and let us know what you're thinking as much as you can, as much as an audio call allows, but we're hoping that we'll be able to have some really active and engaged discussion. We want to encourage the sharing and brainstorming ideas of everybody here, which is why we subtitle these calls Peers and Mentors, Just a Phone Call Away. As you may remember, the way that you can participate in the conversation today is to press star 1 and let the operator know you have a comment or something you'd like to share, or you can also send us an email. In our fishbowl today, we have several of our faculty and staff from the Advocacy Learning Center, Priya from Manavi, Liz, Beth, and Diane from Praxis, and Sandra Pilgrim-Lewis, one of the ALC faculty. Welcome to all of you. It's good to have you here today. Before we jump in, though, and get into this hot topic today, let's hear from Liz about some of the technical aspects of today's call. Liz, what do we need to know as we go through the call today?
Thanks, Kata. Well, as you prefaced a moment ago, because this call has phone lines muted for participants while the fishbowl speakers are kind of engaging in the dialogue, we want to hear from you at any point. And so just know that all you need to do is press star 1 on your keypad, and that will get you into the operator queue. And after a moment or two, we will do our best to incorporate you into the conversation. So just recognize that that is possible at any time. Anyone who would prefer to send a comment or a question by email, feel free to do that by sending a note to advocacy@praxisinternational.org. Or if you happen to have a technical issue or a glitch that you would like to let us know about, also just send a note to advocacy@praxisinternational.org. And finally, since this call is recorded, you can feel free to review the recording at any time after it is posted on the ALC class webpage. So look for it there. That's it from me, Kata.
Thank you, Liz. It's good to have those reminders and know that you're there backing us up. Well, as I said, we have a fascinating conversation to start today, and we'll continue over the next three calls of the affinity discussions. As advocates, we've all collectively grappled with the issue of shelter rules for years and years. As we move through the Advocacy Learning Center together, this is an ideal topic for us to explore as we work towards creating change that strengthens our advocacy and promotes ultimate social change around violence against women. Shelter rules are typically created in a way as an attempt to prevent bad or harmful situations or events from happening, or to protect the people that are in the shelter. Rules do this by controlling behavior. But ironically, abusers also use rules to control behavior in domestic violence situations. So as advocates in a shelter, we've not set out to recreate abusive or controlling environments, but somehow it seems that we risk that happening at times in our shelters. Over the course of the next three calls, we're really going to explore this reality and encourage all of you to put on your thinking caps and let's think honestly and reflectively about where we're at around this issue. First, we're going to look at the historical perspective. How was it when shelters first opened, and when and how did shelter rules develop? We're also going to look at the most common problems that were identified in a study called Meeting Survivors' Needs, a multi-state study of domestic violence shelter experiences. And then we're going to consider recommendations. What do we do? Where do we start? And through that, we're going to do some intensive examination of several state coalitions who've undergone discussion and exploration with their programs about the possibility of a different approach to shelter rules. We're hoping that we can come up with some practical applications about changing shelters and address some of the challenges and possible resolutions, as well as give you resources that can support your own thinking and action around this topic. We know it's going to be a very thought-provoking dialogue, and we also wanted to make sure that it's very practical and useful for you as we strengthen our social change advocacy work. So, to that end, we are very excited to have a guest with us today who's going to help guide us in that conversation. Anne Menard is an activist who has worked on policy, practice, and research issues affecting domestic violence and sexual assault survivors since the mid-1970s. Her particular focus has been on survivor-defined advocacy and public policy and research affecting women and their families, especially those living in poverty. After serving as a senior consultant to the Family Violence Prevention and Services Program of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services during 2005, she returned as director of the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence, a position she previously held from 1994 to 1999. Prior to this national-level work, Anne led the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and in the early 1980s co-directed Connecticut's largest domestic violence shelter and was also actively involved in grassroots sexual assault advocacy. So Anne has a wealth of experience and knowledge that I think will be very helpful for us today. Welcome, Anne. We're so happy to have you here with us today.
And I'm very happy to be here.
Well, let's jump right in, because I know people have lots of thoughts and ideas on this issue, including yourself. And again, we're really hoping that everyone who's on the call today will let us know what you think, what your thoughts and questions are. But we're going to start off with asking Anne to talk a little bit about a study that the NRCDV conducted in 2008 titled Meeting Survivors' Needs, a Multi-State Study of Domestic Violence Shelter Experiences. And everybody was sent a summary of the findings from that study, so that might be a good thing to reference as we listen to Anne and have this conversation today. But Anne, can you tell us a little bit about that study and what were some of the things that you learned through it?
And again, thanks to Kata and everyone that is involved in pulling these calls together. One of the reasons I'm happy to be here is that I consider this to be a really important, timely, and I think fascinating topic. And I'm really pleased to have an opportunity to be part of your conversation. I know that I'll be talking a lot at the beginning, but really look forward to hearing others' comments, thoughts, questions, anxieties about this whole area of our advocacy. Let me give you an overview, and then I know I'll have an opportunity later on to talk about some of the specific findings. But the Meeting Survivors Needs Shelter Study was developed by the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence, working collaboratively with Dr. Eleanor Lyon at the UConn School of Social Work. And we designed this to help fill gaps in our current knowledge about the range of services that domestic violence shelters provide, the needs and experiences of survivors who turn to shelters for help, and the types of help that those survivors receive at shelter programs. Data were collected in late 2007 and early 2008 through surveys completed by over 3,400 residents of 215 domestic violence shelters located in 8 states. Researchers chose these states to maximize geographic, population, rural, urban, suburban, and economic diversity. The large sample size, 3,400 respondents, the inclusion of shelter programs from 8 diverse states, the variety of communities in which the shelters themselves were located, and the diverse needs of those that they serve make this a reasonable reflection of shelters across the nation. So that's important to know as well. Shelter residents were asked to complete a written survey at or near their entrance into the shelter, and again at or near their exit from the shelter. The survey instruments were translated into 11 languages to increase accessibility. Most were completed in English or Spanish. Both surveys asked about 38 different possible areas of interest. probing survivors' entry experiences, their needs, the extent to which their needs were met as they defined them, any conflicts or problems with rules they encountered, changes they attributed to their shelter stay, and their ratings of the help that they received, including difficulties experienced during the stay and the respect and support survivors received from shelter staff. In addition to the enormous amount of data collected from survivors themselves, programs that were participating provided information about their capacity, the number of beds and staff and other information like that, and the services that they provide. Researchers also collected census data about the regions served by the shelters. First, I need to say that the shelter study showed that shelters play a critical and positive role in the vast number of residents in the lives of survivors that seek shelter. So that's important to know as a kind of an overall finding of the shelter. But it also showed to our topic today that some survivors struggle with shelter rules related in a couple of areas in particular, including eligibility for admission, such as survivors with teenage boys or those with arrest records and whether or not they would be admitted into a particular shelter, what they must do when they are in residence, and that went to rules and related to curfew or chores, and how long they may stay, so time limit that might be attached to particular shelters. So the study and the survivors' voices that it captures suggest that there are important questions we can ask about the role of rules in our DV shelters and in other settings in which we have contact with domestic violence and sexual assault survivors.
Wow, that's remarkable to have 3,400 respondents and also get information from the program. That gives a lot of validity to the study, I would imagine, Anne. Thank you for summarizing that. Before we go into detail about some of the findings, I'm just curious, what led you to even include questions about shelter rules in this study?
Well, that's a great question. And, I mean, historically, as you said in your introduction, during the 30 years that shelters have existed, rules were developed to ensure the safe and smooth operation of the shelter. So no violence, watch your kids, let us know where you are. And rules were typically created, as you said, to control behavior. Often they are made as an attempt to prevent bad or harmful situations or events from happening in this communal living setting. But advocates have repeatedly said that rules were created often because of a single instance. So one time something happened, and shelter staff or management made a rule to try to prevent that the reoccurrence of that one-time event. So, for example, a teen boy came into the shelter with his mom, and he acted out, and something bad happened, or some women were, you know, afraid or felt unsafe, whatever. Or women stayed out at night, and staff were worried, so a curfew was created for everyone. And including those residents who worked at night, and so you can begin to see some of the conflicts that arose. You can usually trace rules, every single rule that exists in shelters, back to a specific event that occurred, either at that shelter or in another shelter in the state, because, again, we have these great networks where we learn from each other's experiences, and so there was also a lot of transfer, so it didn't even have to happen in your shelter. Something happened at a neighboring shelter, even in another state, and so rules became more frequent, and they kind of built on each other. So that's, you know, kind of historically where rules came from. But also to your question, there have been three main influence for my particular interest in shelter rules and this discussion, and why we included the shelter rules questions in the shelter study in particular that I want to share. One influence was the Documenting Our Work project that was initiated by the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence in early 2001-2003, where we were responding to the fact that we had very little information at that point about what we do, why we do what we do, why we do it the way we do it, and what values and assumptions, you know, still underlay our approaches. So we weren't doing a very good job of documenting our work, hence the title of that project. And we also wanted to support critical thinking about all aspects of our advocacy. So the NRC, National Resource Center, worked with Sujata Warrior, Dr. Eleanor Lyon, a number of great advocates working at the local level and at the state coalition level, as well as allied researchers like Julia Perillo, Mieko Yoshihama, and Chris Sullivan, on framing a set of assessment tools for programs to use to, support critical thinking about our work, particularly in the shelter context. And in this shelter context, it felt very important to include questions about the admission criteria for services, who gets in the door and who's excluded, as well as other access issues related to disability, life circumstances, for example, what happens when a survivor has a criminal record, for example, and access issues related to language, sexual orientation, and other issues. So this led to critical thinking questions like, who gets excluded from your services? Again, questions that programs could ask themselves. Who gets excluded? Who doesn't even get in the door? Do these intake policies and practices affect different groups of survivors differently? So is there any kind of disproportionate impact that we need to pay attention to? What happens to survivors when they don't make it in the door? What kinds of resources and supports is the program providing, or are they just left on their own? We also included in this assessment and critical thinking, assessment and critical thinking tools, questions about rules in the shelter. And at that point in 2001, 2003, we identified 21 rules that were pretty common in shelter programs. And this led to questions about what are the most common reasons that shelter residents are asked to leave. What are the implications for survivors in danger when they are made to leave a shelter for a rules violation? How can residents themselves be involved in a process of looking at shelter rules? So we'd done all that thinking, and again, it involved a lot of people, and it's really interesting. So when we were given the opportunity to design and implement a shelter study, we built on that earlier work in the documenting our work project and pulled a lot of these assessment and critical thinking questions into the Meeting Survivors Needs study. But for me, there's also two personal places that have given me insights and interest in our ongoing examination of the implications of shelter rules. One is very personal. I grew up in a family of 10 in a house with only one bathroom with a bath and shower. So privacy, conflict, sense of fairness. I was the oldest girl, so I had my own little closet-sized room until I left for college, at which point my next oldest sister was waiting outside with her things to move in before I had even finished packing for college. But everyone else shared rooms with 1 to 3 siblings. I get communal living at a real basic level, its joys, its challenges, and the needs to manage how it all works for everyone, and that individuals respond to chaos and shared responsibility very differently, even in a family. Never mind when communal living involves different families in different stages of crises. So this leaves me very sympathetic to our inclination to try to create order in a naturally chaotic environment of a communal domestic violence shelter environment. The second perspective I continue to bring to these discussions about shelter rules is that of someone who would definitely not have been able to comply with several of the well-intentioned rules that were in place at the shelter I had the privilege to be co-coordinator of in the mid-1970s. While I was there, I had my son, who's a great kid, but as a kid, he was a bolter. He would not stay in one place and move pretty quickly once he could walk. So it was physically impossible for me to keep my eyes on him at all times, which was one of our shelter rules, unless I restrained him, which would have run me afoul of another expectation, if not a rule, at our shelter that we weren't restraining our children. So I was musing about this at a staff meeting one day, and we started talking about our rules. And to a person, so this was in, 1978, 1979, and to a person, all of us shelter staff, majority formerly battered women and or sexual assault survivors, 2 recovering alcoholics, 1 former prostitute, 3 women with criminal records, including me, given my anti-Vietnam War activism in college, 1 woman with 6 kids, 2 immigrants. Each of us could think of a reason we would have been screened out or been asked to leave our shelter. And we had a great shelter with incredible advocates who were so passionate about this work. So as a result of this discussion, we began having a conversation and talked to residents and rethought a lot of things. We did this in a much more clunky and unsophisticated way than the Missouri Coalition and the Washington State Coalition Shelter Rules Reduction Initiatives, which I know you're going to be hearing about, and have produced wonderful resources and tools. But still, we began that conversation. So for me, this has been almost 30-year conversation. So including questions about shelter rules was a no-brainer when we came to designing the shelter study.
Well, I appreciate that historical overview, and it's important to acknowledge the sensitivity of having this conversation, which you so eloquently described, because of the desire to be helpful and to be protective and balanced and fair, and the challenges of communal living. But I think your self-reflection about what you went through at the shelter that you worked at with your coworkers is very telling, and probably a lot of us have been in similar situations where we might not be able to follow the rules of places that we've worked or shelters that we've worked. It also speaks to a lot of what we promote at the Advocacy Learning Center, which is we really encourage critical thinking and thinking in broad ways about social change that are very connected to individual experiences, that when we come together collectively, we can really create that lasting change. So it's a good moment maybe to remind all of our participants on the call today that we want to hear from you and see what you're thinking, what your experiences have been, what you've tried in your community or considering trying. So please let us know. Press star 1 and tell the operator that you have a call or, you have a question or a comment, or email to advocacy@praxisinternational.org. I do want to, while we're paused, take a moment and apologize. I had said that the summary of the study that Anne is talking about was sent out to people in publicity, but it's actually available on the class page, on the protected class page of the website. So if you were looking for it in the publicity, I'm sorry, it's not there, but it's on the website. You can access it and might find it useful either during this conversation or afterwards. And let's, while we're paused, also see if any of the other people in the fishbowl have a comment or a thought that relates to what Anne has shared with us around this study and the history of some of how she and the study came to this point. Priya, Liz, Beth, Diane, Sandra, anything you want to add to the conversation at this point?
This is Sandra, and there was something that Anne said that I was so moved by and took me back to the experience when we kind of looked at shelter rules, and whether you're doing it with a research specialist or you're doing it on your own, there was one thing that was very common, and that was the listening to survivors. And if we really listen to what survivors have to say, whether it's the woman with 6 children, the immigrants, the person who was a prostitute, whatever their background is, they bring valuable perspectives to us and help us to remember whose shelter is it anyway. It's really not our shelter. It's the shelter of the survivors. And taking the time to listen to what those survivors say can really help us as we struggle with what should those guidelines be. And I really like that term, guidelines versus rules.
That's a great point, Sandra, and that certainly feeds into so much of what we talk at the Advocacy Learning Center about, which is that we're doing this work with women and with survivors, and that's essential to creating that social change. So thank you for highlighting that. Priya, Liz, Beth, Diane, any other thoughts you'd like to add to the conversation at this point? Okay. I'll take that silence to mean that you're thinking about these very deep considerations. And again, I encourage all of our fishbowl participants, but also all of our people who have called in today on as participants to let us know what you're thinking about. So, Anne, as people are thinking about these challenging issues and interesting points that you're making, I wonder if you could tell us more specifically about what you found in the study and what you learned that survivors say about shelter rules.
Happy to do this. And again, I was happy to pull out the piece that was referenced earlier, Survivors' Responses to Shelter Rules, Findings from Meeting Survivors' Needs Study, specifically pulls out the findings, most of the findings. I actually found some others that I'll review as well. But, you know, as we all know, shelter residents face a variety of problems and challenges, attributable in large part to their sudden change of circumstances, living in close proximity with other families, which, again, unless you've been in a communal living situation of a large family or some other type of situation like that is really foreign, as well as the crisis that led them to seek shelter in the first place. And their interest in and their need to attend to their children's reaction. So these are all things that create, particular challenges in creating a safe and supportive shelter environment. In this study, the Meeting Survivors Needs Study, survivors noted a range of challenges, including, relate to these from my own experience as well, finding privacy, getting along with other residents, and understanding and complying with shelter rules. And you'll see that that's something that emerged as a key finding, that, there's the issue of complying or, being able to manage under the shelter rules, but there was also an issue. We heard a lot that residents and survivors had trouble even understanding what the rules were, so that's important as well. So, respondents to the survey were asked about a variety of problems that the literature, in other words, the research, and again, the experience of advocates suggest are possible in shelters. They were also asked whether or not the problem that they encountered was resolved, because problems come up all the time, and so that can't be the only measure. We also want to know whether there was support or commitment to try to resolve problems as they arose. So those were two important things we looked at. Problems with shelter rules included issues with time limits. So 16% of shelter residents reported having problems. 50% reported that those issues were resolved. So that's a good thing, but 50% indicated that those issues were not resolved. Curfew, again, 14% identified a concern about curfew. Again, 61% had those issues resolved. Child discipline and monitoring, 13% experienced, 16% had those issues resolved. And chores, 13% identified that was a problem for them, and about 60% had those resolved. So let's go into those a little bit more.
Before you go into detail, we actually have a couple of comments that I want people to participate. But you were just about to say something, so I didn't want to cut off your final.
No, this is a good time to. No, I was just going to go through all of those in more detail. So, a great time to be interrupted.
Okay, that's great. Great. We have a question or a person in the queue. Why don't we first hear from that person? Operator, and then there's an email comment that was sent in, too. So go ahead.
Yes, we have a comment from Native Alliance again. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Dawn. And my question was, when you gave the shelter visitors the survey, did you ask or did you get any feedback as to whether or not they felt that it was a requirement that they fill it out upon being accepted for services?
Excellent question. There was a lot of attention paid during the survey to have it be disconnected with any decisions about their So these are women who were able to walk through the door. So they were in shelter. We provided a lot of training to the programs that participated and a lot of guidance on how to do this in a way that acknowledged and honored the fact that folks were in crisis. And so these were not, you know, so there was they weren't provided an opportunity to participate in the study until they were through that the initial, you know, crisis that brought them to the shelter door that first day or night. The responses were totally confidential. In other words, they completed the survey, they had an envelope, and they put it in a box that the staff sealed, and then that was sent directly to the researcher. So there was no, and that was stressed that their responses were confidential, their privacy was protected, and that so there were lots of, again, this was designed by folks who'd been doing advocacy for a long time, so paid a lot of attention to not wanting, it was totally voluntary. And one of the things, so we were really pleased with the number of survivors across these 215 programs that participated. The survey instrument itself, this is another thing that I think maybe goes to your question, that the survey had a lot of quantitative questions. In other words, survivors were asked to kind of check what things were important to them. And then, but there were also lots of spaces for survivors to write, to just say what they needed to say. And an amazing number of survivors spent time writing and wrote a lot. And so that, I think, added incredible richness to the responses and, you know, provided more context and all of that. So, and in many ways, we also got comments that survivors were very pleased to be asked.
Okay.
Opinion. So it was. I mean, not only were people not feeling coerced, they were just thrilled and felt very validated to be asked about what their experiences were. So I hope that answers your question. I'm happy to provide more information.
It does. It does. I had one more question, and because our coalition serves the Oklahoma tribal programs, we only have four tribes that have shelter programs, and so most of the tribal programs have contracts with the shelter services that are provided by state programs. So something that we were wanting to assess was, were there any cultural needs that the shelter visitors had that maybe weren't met? And then also the second question was, Did you bring those needs to the attention of shelter staff? Did you ask any cultural specific questions?
We did. So I'm just focusing on the shelter rules questions today, but there were questions related to the extent to which the resident survivor felt respected based on their culture. I can't remember the exact questions, but their culture. Then there was another question about there was their religion respected. Did they feel that they received that their age, in other words, that there was that sort of the various things that were important to them about who they were those things with the staff and the volunteers that they had contact with respectful? And again, that's another whole, I mean, there is all
sure.
sorts of important information that was shared there. And we also asked questions that went to outcomes. In other words, one of the questions was, which folks particularly responded in writing to was, what would you have done if the shelter had not been available to you? And women talked about, I would have been killed. I would still be living under a bridge with my kids. I mean, just things that, again, we all know as advocates are realities, but for women to say in this kind of study, to be so direct about what would have happened if they had not been able to secure shelter when they did. So there were, again, both very validating data about the critical role that shelters are playing in survivors' lives, as well as lots of information, including about shelter rules, but in other areas as well, that speak to issues that we need to pay attention to and engage in critical thinking and be talking to survivors about more and looking at making some changes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Dawn, for those questions. They're very, very important, and of course, gave a wonderful summary to that. Let me read the email comment that was sent to us by Jeanette at Mount Graham Safe House, which I'm afraid I don't remember where that is. So, Beth, feel free to pipe in to let us know what state that's from. But Jeanette writes, "We tried a no-rules situation in our shelter. That was a phenomenal failure. The residents were very unhappy, and the staff were not really enjoying their work either. So we switched to a reduced rules program. We have very few rules, all health and safety related. We have no curfew, no age, sex restrictions for entry, et cetera." So thank you, Jeanette, for sharing that experience. And Jeanette is from?
Arizona.
Arizona. Okay.
Arizona, okay. Oh, yeah, Arizona's been doing some interesting work in this area. Yeah.
Yeah, so Anne, do you want to respond? And then, of course, other people.
Yeah, I think, and again, I know that this is the first of a three-part conversation, and I know my colleagues from Missouri and Washington State, which are two state coalitions and, of course, their member programs that have engaged in a really thoughtful process to, you know, to look at shelter rules. And again, you know, and I think you're going to be getting a copy of the How the Earth Didn't Fly Into the Sun, Missouri's Project to Reduce Rules in Domestic Violence Shelters, which the National Resource Center was very pleased to help the Missouri Coalition publish, because it does document how a process of looking at rules and reducing rules as opposed to just eliminating rules can be structured, again, as I think the findings of the study I'm talking about today urges us to do, because there are survivors in our shelters that are struggling within some of the rule structures that we have. But, you know, as the emailer said, just jumping to no rules is maybe not the best response, but certainly a process that engages in critical thinking, includes survivors in the discussion, and, you know, and helps build a sense of confidence and consensus around what makes sense for, you know, for each particular shelter.
Yeah, I think that's really important, Anne. No one right now is proposing anything, actually. We're just trying to establish a foundation of understanding and then think this through together, as you have demonstrated that you all did so wonderfully at the NRCDV and in Missouri and Washington and other communities. We're just really eager to hear what people are thinking and what they're struggling with and put our thinking caps together. So thank you, Jeanette, for sharing that example, and Dawn, for asking those questions. We really do hope that many, many others of you will either email your thoughts or questions or examples to advocacy@praxisinternational.org or join the conversation by pressing *1 and letting the operator know that you have something you'd like to share. I know, Anne, that you were about
to... Well, you actually have another
one. Oh, you do?
Yes.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
It comes from Deaf Unity. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, everyone. This is Veronica Clark from Deaf Unity in Madison, Wisconsin. And I just have a question as I'm listening regarding the study and if disability, I don't think disability was mentioned in regards to the study, and I was just wondering if disability in general or specific to the deaf and hard of hearing population, if those populations were considered, and you know, were there questions regarding accessibility to the services within the shelter given to the participants? I appreciate the question earlier about cultural sensitivity because of the deaf community. We're looking at cultural sensitivity as well. But I'm also thinking of the specific needs of all the individuals or the victims that utilize a shelter. And you know, how did that work into the study if there were, you know, special needs that were brought attention to that had to be addressed throughout the study or not? Thank you.
Absolutely, yes, and no. I'm smiling at the questions because, of course, we should be accountable to to all of those questions and all of those interests. And I think we did a pretty good job. Yes, there were questions about. So when we looked at access issues, disability was one. The rules. We were looking at rules and access issues from a number of perspectives. We were interested in, criminal history, criminal records, whether there were any, physical barriers to access. The structure of the first part of the study was, what were you looking for when you reached out to shelter? And we didn't presume to know what that was. So there were 38 or 54, some amazing number that we thought, oh, my gosh, survivors aren't going to be interested in answering this. And they just were very discerning about what they said. So, then in the second survey, we asked how many of those needs were met. So, for example, one of the questions was, were you looking for help around your disability or the disability of a child? So that was something that a survivor could say, yes, I'm looking for help or assistance around this. And then they were given a second opportunity after they'd been in the shelter to identify whether they got those needs met, whether they got assistance. And that's where we uncovered that where some needs were being met more consistently than others. It also helped us match or not match, or identify where there was a mismatch between what survivors and different kinds of survivors, because we did have demographic information about the respondents, what different survivors were looking for when they reached out to a shelter, what they received, and what wasn't met. So we could there's the full report's 300 pages long, so there's really lots of data there, and we looked at all of those issues. Again, shelter rules was just one piece. It wasn't a shelter rules study. That was just one of the things that we were concerned about. We were concerned about, again, needs, experiences, how survivors themselves identified needs, how that might be different than what we prioritize as programs, what we think, right? Like, here, this is what you need. Like, protection orders wasn't the first on the list. Housing was, those kinds of things. What needs, what concerns and interests they had related to their children, et cetera. So there's, again, lots of information. We were very pleased that 3,400 survivors shared their thoughts and feelings with us, and shelter rules was one of those areas. We did a companion study 2 years later that looked at non-residential services, and we tried to look at all of the learnings that we had in the first study. And so, for example, we oversampled culturally specific programs. We had our culturally specific resource center partners identify culturally specific programs in the states that maybe weren't part of the coalition and so weren't identified. So, and again, we also had some disability rights partners, and so I think we did an even better job in the non-residential services study capturing the voices and experiences of a broader set of populations.
And this is Beth. I just wanted to remind people, as soon as I started digging into this survey, a little while back, I couldn't start reading, and I know when you said it was 300 pages, I know it was 300 pages because you can't stop reading, and it takes a really long time to mesh through them. But you very kindly gave us two links that we put on our website that I think would be incredibly interesting for people to download. One is the findings, survivors' responses to shelter rules, which was what we were focusing this call on, but there's also another link that you provided that gives a summary of all the findings, which is also very fascinating. So for all of you who are saying, but what else did you ask and did you include, I would encourage you to jump on that link, and it gives you just a really great overview of the entire study. So,
yeah, there's research and briefs. There's the executive summary, which is certainly a little bit shorter, and then there's the full report. So, yeah. Do you want me to just go go back to just – I just want to – this will probably take about 5 minutes or so, which just the specific findings around time limits and some of the –
That would
some
be really helpful. And let me just make sure. I'm not clear. Is there another person in the queue, Shane, or did we get all the folks that are waiting?
That was last one in the queue.
Okay, great. That's great. So thank you, Veronica, for those questions, and Beth for reminding us about the resource we have available on the website. But yes, Anne, if you could please just finish your description of some of the findings, I think that's going to probably stimulate even more comments and questions.
Great. And this piece that I did send out that I'm referencing now is only 3 pages, so it's a little bit more accessible for busy advocates. So specific findings, and there's four areas in particular: time limits, curfew issues, child discipline issues, and chores. So time limits, and again, I think this won't be a surprise to anyone, many residents felt that time limits were too short, inflexible, or not explained clearly with appropriate notice. And again, I think that's real important feedback. Many noted that the time limits didn't take into consideration that finding other living arrangements was difficult. One survivor wrote, "Not my fault, apartments were full and I couldn't afford them." Another observed that the shelter need to realize that some people have nowhere to go at all. Some felt that time limits forced them to go back to the abuser. I was there for 90 days, which is 60 days longer than at many shelters, so I think we can all appreciate that. I was here for 90 days, then ended up back in my abusive relationship because I had nowhere to go. One also noted she felt overwhelmed and anxiety, worrying about the time limit. And we continue to hear this a lot. So 50% of survivors who identified time limit issues felt that their problems were resolved. So either, you know, for the person who wasn't clear on what the time limit was, you know, got more information, and other folks maybe got some additional help as they were leaving. The curfew issues rose pretty high here. The issues included conflicts with work and church. One noted that it was embarrassing to leave church because of the curfew. I had not thought of that as an implication of curfew, so that was really important, I think, for many of us to hear. Another stated evening service, church functions, visits with the daughter, all no. Some felt that the curfew was too early. Quote, "We are grown women. 8 o'clock is ridiculous." And that there was unequal enforcement. They said no curfew, but one woman and kids were kicked out when they came home at 9.05 p.m. Others believe that curfew should be flexible, unbending. Mothers and children should be able to spend time together at Christmas. Some thought that curfew should be extended on weekends. Still others noted that it was annoying but understandable for safety. So again, you know, when we listen to survivors, we're going to hear different perspectives. And so some survivors also validated that there's a good reason that some of these rules exist. And the one that particularly irritates me, I'll just be real honest about this, is because of rules related to curfews, that women are forced to quit their jobs. Is so counter to and I think we'll get to this, but I'd be particularly interested in other people's sort of kind of analysis or critical thinking around what it means when we have a shelter rule that requires women to quit a job in order to stay in shelter. The children's discipline issues, as you can imagine, we got complex feedback. Some survivors reported problems with other residents' child monitoring. As one complained, some parents left other parents to discipline and monitor their children. So that would suggest that they're in support for rules or guidance or an understanding that mothers or parents needed to be responsible for their kids. Another observed the following: "At times, I felt there was little or no discipline. I felt that some of the children in this home at times were totally out of control, with parents taking advantage of everything good that this home represents, and also so much disrespect to the other people and staff. I love children and do understand that they're just that, children. As far as I'm concerned, there's no excuse for certain parents." So again, there's some, you know, interesting tension there. And how do we respond to that? Others talked about the I cannot do chores and watch my children at the same time. So they felt like they, you know, were compromised with rules that competed with one another. There were also, and this sometimes had a cultural connection and sometimes didn't, or were, you know, culturally specific, that prohibition against corporal punishment. One commented that my children wanted to run over me because they knew they couldn't be spanked. Another wrote that he is my child, and I should be able to spank if I want. So again, I think the child discipline issues are really complex, and listening to survivors is not going to necessarily give one answer, but then the challenge is balancing different ideas about parenting, cultural practices around parenting, and as well as a concern about children being safe and supported. Chores, again, not a surprise to most of you, I'm sure, feeling that chores were unequally enforced. One wrote, or that exceptions were not considered. So one wrote, because of my health condition, I'm not able to lift and drag a commercial mop or move furniture or inhale bleach or insecticide. Another objected to, the day you were supposed to mop the floor with ammonia, I'm 3 months pregnant. Other such chores were done properly. By some, there wasn't enough structure. Staff allowed other residents to be in control of chores, so I felt I had to respond to other residents and not staff. And then the rules around chores conflicting with the expectations around jobs and children. It's very hard to hold down a full-time job and make time for my children and do chores. So, you know, how things, you know, sort of how do all these things kind of interact in an individual or an individual family's lives as well as the collective. So overall, the problems survivors identified that were most likely to be resolved were conflicts with other women. And that may or may not be rule related. 73% of those they reported were resolved. Issues with contacting their partner, and that's another area where there are rules. There are frequently rules, and the majority felt that those issues were resolved within their time at the shelter. Issues with child discipline and monitoring, a good over 50%, as well as issues with curfew. And problems with language and communication. The problems that were least likely to be resolved were feelings that their customs were not respected, so that goes to one of the earlier questions, which is experienced by 5%, so, you know, a small but important number. But for those 5%, only 39% felt that those issues were resolved while they were at the shelter. The policies on teen boys, which is reported by 4% of the survey respondents, and 43%, less than half, had those issues resolved. Issues with the available food, which is a problem for 13% of the respondents, and less than half felt those issues were resolved. And getting privacy was another area that's a hard one to resolve, actually. So that's the information that I included on the summary of the findings. But when I was looking at it again today, there was another thing that I just wanted to share. We also asked, as another indicator of satisfaction, is whether or not they would recommend the shelter that they stayed at, to a friend. And reasons for why they would not recommend the shelter to a friend included that they don't agree with many of the rules. So because of their experience with the rules, they would not suggest this as an option to a friend who needed this kind of support. Other responses were because some staff don't understand when you're running for your life. Every situation is unique and need to be evaluated individually. I actually like the place, but the staff would set someone back to a point unable to recover. So again, I want to remind you that I'm talking about focusing today on the things that where there was concerns raised by the survey respondents. There was also lots of positive affirmation about, again, the role that shelters play in the lives of survivors. And so I don't want to skew your understanding or make you feel bad what this says, though, is that there's a lot here that survivors are asking us to look at, and we can probably do a better job of balancing the needs of communal living with the needs of individual survivors who reach out to shelter.
That's really helpful, Anne. I'm very taken by the word that you used a few times, which is that it's very complex. Certainly both understanding the findings as well as thinking about what we're doing and what we might do differently is not simple, which is why we so appreciate your time in helping us think this through today. I, again, want to encourage anybody who's on the call, any of our participants, to press *1 with a comment or a question or an example or a thought. We really want to hear from you. We've appreciated everyone's participation so far. as well as if you'd rather just email your comment to advocacy at praxisinternational.org, then we'll read it out and have discussion with you in that way. But Anne's raised a lot of really interesting pieces of information regarding this issue. So I wonder if anybody in our fishbowl, Sandra, Diane, Beth, Priya, if you have any thoughts or comments and as you listen to what Anne's been describing.
Heather, this is Beth, and I just have one more question about findings that I'm curious about, because I've been brainstorming with quite a few programs over the last couple of months, and this particular issue comes up a lot in our conversations around shelter rules, and that's kind of this wider area of confidentiality and whether we have shelters that are in confidential locations or not, which then transposes into a lot of rules that shelters have around who can come. You know, can extended family and friends be a part of your life while at the shelter, answering telephones, giving out numbers, ride sharing and transportation, where do you get dropped off, where do you get picked up, all of those kinds of pieces impact women's lives tremendously in shelter. So I just wondered if any part of the study had any insight into findings about what survivors have indicated about their experiences there.
You know, it reminds me of one of the findings that I thought was really particularly interesting, and where there were differences across different demographic groups. And that was one of the options, and sort of what were you looking for when you reached out to shelter, and then what, you know, tell us how much of this kind of help in this area you received when you're at the shelter. So one of the options was help reconnecting with my community. And that was endorsed, which means that people said, yes, that's what I was looking for, and may or may not have received received support in that area. Another one that I think goes to your question was getting help for my partner, my abusive partner, which speaks to, again, the reality that many survivors remain in contact and remain in contact with their abusive partner because of children, because of, you know, interest in ongoing relationship, because of court mandates, whatever, and that they want their partner to change their abusive behavior. And so those, it was interesting to us, again, these are all folks who've been doing this work for a really long time, how frequently survivors identified those types of issues. Contact with family and friends also came up within the context of the shelter rules, and there was clear frustration on certainly many survivors' parts that they were not. So we know that isolation is a tactic, isolating, you know, victims and survivors from their community, from their family, from their friends, is a tactic that abusers use. And yet, for safety reasons, we often have rules or requirements that say that they cannot contact anybody, and for reasons that you said, that they might disclose the location of the shelter or whatever. I think those issues are much more complex now, and in some ways some of the rules are silly because of the number of individuals who have cell phones, which is almost everybody. So the ability to make calls and not have it be on the, you know, the shelter pay phone or the shelter office phone. People have their own phone. So that, I think, would by itself cause us to need to rethink all of that. I also think the critical thinking that we've done around advocacy beyond leaving, in other words, which is acknowledging that that many survivors, not all, want our help in staying safe and, you know, staying connected to an abusive partner, but getting help for that abusive partner. So again, that's another set of critical thinking that I think brings us back to shelter rules and what are we saying? What is our message in the rule? How justified is it or reasonable is it in the context of survivors and their children's lives today as they live them today? So I don't know if that those are just some things that I thought of in response to what you shared.
Well, again, you're just giving us a lot of really wonderful food for thought, and thank you, Beth, for that question. It makes me think a lot about our core principles of social change advocacy, the first one being that are we creating an experience that is liberating or dominating for survivors? And I think your findings and the points that you're raising really give us pause as we consider that. We do have another question that was emailed into us from Kim at Safe House Center. So I'm just going to read this to you and see, Anne, what you think, and then encourage other people in the fishbowl, our faculty and staff, to respond too, which is, do you know what the outcomes have been for shelters who have eliminated assigning chores to residents? What suggestions do you have for reducing this rule, as it is a huge one for us? And I know that we're going to explore what we can do in future calls, but certainly any thoughts you have at this point, Anne, or Sandra, Beth, Priya, or Diana would be really helpful. Anne, do you have a response?
Oh, what a great question. and I don't know, but I'm going to find out if any of the program. I mean, this has been fairly recent, this you know, focused attention to rules and, you know, critical thinking on rules. But I don't know whether any of the individual shelters or any of the states that have, you know, engaged in a process of reducing rules and, you know, sort of thinking about that have done that in a way that has allowed them to capture any particular impact on. And again, it also raises the question is, what is your goal? What is your goal in this? So what would a success measure be? Would the success be that obviously the safety of the shelter remains high, but the comfort level also remains high? So that's an interesting question. I don't know that anyone's done that, but we should do that as more and more programs are moving in this direction, and we could actually easily try to figure out a way to do that under the National Resource Center's DV Evidence Project, which is giving us a platform for which to continue to build our evidence that our practices, particularly practices that we're changing in response to feedback from survivors, that those changes in practices are in fact responsive to what survivors identified for us. So thank you for that. And I will look around to see if anyone has measured the impact of a reduction in rules. And if I do find something, I will send that off to Liz and her colleagues.
And there's one more little thing I'd say. You'll all be receiving, there's a link on our website, like I mentioned, but Anne has very graciously offered to mail each of you a hard copy of the Missouri's Project to Reduce Shelter Rules and Domestic Violence Shelters. It's called How the Earth Didn't Fly Into the Sun, which I love, absolutely love that title.
Greatest title ever.
It is. I have to say it should win some sort of award, but yeah. It's a beautiful manual, and you'll get a hard copy of it. And so in, I think it's chapter 4, they talk about, you know, kind of the bumps and hurdles around curfew and chores and watching children and discipline and all of those kinds of pieces are talked about. So if nothing else, Kim, it might just unearth a lot of discussion on your part if you read that as a team and kind of talk further about what would happen if we did this, what would happen, what would change, all those kinds of things. So. You'll be receiving that in your mailbox.
Great. And the other thing I just want to mention, because one of the things that we did as a result of some of the findings in the study is try to identify where is it, you know, to raise some of them up and then provide some technical assistance resources. And it became clear, much more so than we expected, that, you know, problems arise in any kind of communal living system. Problems are going to arise. So one of the things that impacts the survivor's experiences in that environment is not that whether it's problem-free, which would be unrealistic, but whether when problems arise, there's a way to respond to them. And so it raises the question, and that was one of the recommendations by that is included in the study, is that shelters really should be making sure that their staff have good conflict resolution strategies. Again, whether it's conflicts between residents or conflicts between residents and staff or conflicts with a rule or an expectation or a guideline, whatever, that staff are really prepared and confident and have a full toolbox of how to engage in constructive conflict resolution so that that conflict, that unresolved conflict, doesn't negatively impact an already stressful situation. I think all of us recognize that we would, that we would hope that shelters would never be necessary for anybody, but they're important that they exist now. We want to try to make them as helpful and comfortable for folks as possible. So that was the making sure that there's a strategy for dealing with conflict, and that whether it's volunteers or staff that are working in shelters, that we would need to make sure that they're prepared to respond.
This is Sandra, and I just want
to just really quick before you respond, and I do want to hear what you have to say. We do have someone who's been waiting very patiently in the queue for a while, so let's have them let's invite them in and have them make their comment, and then let's hear from Sandra and Anne as well. So Shane, can you bring that person in?
Yes, it's from Midland House Shelter. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question. One of the things we have done is reduced a lot of our rules, and we're seeing some great success with that. But one of the things that we have reduced was overnight stays. Like before, it had to be something major to be somebody to have an overnight stay. But we are now have lifted that hey, as long as they're communicating with us, and there's a reason for it, even if the reason is, hey, I just really need to get out of here and have a break, that's fine. But sometimes we don't know who's coming or who's going, and then we're trying to serve them as advocates, and we're growing frustrated with not being able to meet with people. So I wondered if you had any thoughts on that, or from your study that you saw, or anybody in the fishbowl would have thoughts on how to reduce our stress as we're trying to serve the clients. So,
great question. Anne, do you have thoughts? And then we'll go.
Yeah, this is Anne, and I hope that you will be able to be on the second and third of the calls, where again the folks from the Missouri Coalition, who were one of the first to kind of explore this in an organized way and then document their process, which we were very happy to help support, as well as the Washington State Coalition, who again have been very intentionally working with programs around this, and to see what if that issue's come up for them. I don't remember that coming up as a specific issue other than, rules that prohibited people from staying connected with their community and their families, but not so much what's the alternative to a rule that restricts that. So again, I would encourage you to be on the second and the third call and to see how that's come up for programs in those two states. It's a great question.
Sandra, what are your thoughts? I know you're about to jump in. If it's related to this or something else, go ahead. Sandra, if you're talking.
Oh, okay.
There you go. Gotcha.
If you were talking to me.
Thanks.
I just was wanting to jump onto something that Anne said about being prepared with staff or volunteers or whoever is in the shelter. That I think that when we have rules so much, whether it's around chores or overnight stays or whatever it is, then we set ourselves up to have conflict. But when we give the power back to survivors and give the power to
find resolution to those survivors, and that the role of our staff is not to enforce a rule, but to help find solutions, it seems to work a little better. Because now we're not in that role of enforcement. Survivors have been in situations where they've been living under power and control, and that's what batterers use as rules for power and control. And on some level, we need some rules. But when we give back the power to survivors to decide how it's going to work, and our role becomes that of helping those very survivors solve those problems, they usually work it out because we don't have chore assignments in our shelter. I have the opportunity of visiting other shelters, and I've seen people doing some creative things. I went to one shelter, and they do a token economy. When people decide they want to do a chore, they get some kind of reward for it. I don't know about that, but there's lots of creative things going on within our state and around the nation for people to do away with chores. And so I think that we're a group of very creative advocates, and if we sit down and think about it in different ways, we can come up with some amazing solutions.
That's a great reminder. Thank you, Sandra. It's even though this is a thorny and complicated issue, we really have many programs or states have already grappled with it and come out using some important different methods, and I think all of us have the ability to solve these challenges. Anne, do you have thoughts about what Sandra raised?
I think it's a great point. And one of the things that's exciting about to me and to others, I think that so many individual programs and state coalitions, and certainly the culture-specific our culture-specific resource center partners are, engaging in critical thinking about shelter rules, but also other aspects of how we interact and with survivors, what assumptions we make about what they need, and versus actually asking them what they need. The relationship between individual survivors and their families and their communities, that it's just creating a really fertile ground for us to, I think, examine the extent to which what we're currently doing now, today, is responsive to what survivors' lives are like and what they need. And we're part of a movement that does have ways to share information within states, across states, and so it's much more likely that we're going to benefit from the good thinking that, you know, occurs in Missouri or in Washington State or Vermont. It's also another state that's done a lot of work in this area. And, again, a lot of local programs have done this, regardless of whether they're coalition or has engaged in it. So I'm excited about the questions that are being asked, even if we don't quite have the answers. And I'm also excited because I'm seeing a growing commitment to, you know, as we did at the beginning of this movement, and many programs have continued to do, see survivors as not recipients of service but partners with us in figuring this out. So I think some of the most intractable or issues that seem the most confusing to us, if we, you know, bring them to survivors and say, what would you do? What should we do? We're trying to balance these things in the shelter. That's what we did back in 1978. We said, here's our dilemma. We just realized that most of us wouldn't even get into the shelter or would be kicked out. So how do we balance all these things? You know, and they were really helpful. The survivors were really helpful. It's their space too. So anyway, I just appreciate all the things that was reflected in that comment.
Well, it's very validating, Anne, to have you describe your thought process and your approach and that you've used through your work. It is one of my jobs as moderators to tie back a lot of the content to what we discuss in the Advocacy Learning Center, and I don't know whether you are aware of it or not, you're really touching on many of the core principles of social change advocacy that we promote to the ALC, and certainly this piece of working with women and engaging in dialogue versus providing counseling or advice, we see very central to be able to create lasting social change. And I'm sure it's no accident that that's a part of your approach and the work that you do, too. So thank you for that. On the issue, though, of being responsive and the challenges that some shelters still face or some communities face, we have a comment that was emailed to us that says, we are working with some other partners on the question of how we can expand housing options for domestic violence victim survivors and struggling with what would survivors here use and how can we as a community afford and provide it. We have 27 emergency shelter beds in an aged congregant shelter, but easily over 30 domestic violence calls to 911 on average every day. We know from conversations with survivors and advocates that the rules, such as leave the shelter to look for work, quote-unquote, by 7:30 a.m. and return by 4:30 to parent your children or do chores, these rules are causing many women to refuse to use the shelter, but we've had no success in convincing the nonprofit operator of the shelter to alter those rules because the staff are convinced they must use those rules with their highly challenged, poorly educated residents, quote unquote. Any tips as we continue to grapple with this and seek change and new options? And this writer says she knows other sessions will address this, but any thoughts that Anne or Sandra, Diane, Priya, you folks want to share at this point in response to this? Anne, you want to start us off?
Sure. You know, this is such a, oh boy, a lot packed in that question, too, and that reflection on what the challenges faced by both the program, the community, and then the programs that are trying to be helpful and survivors themselves, obviously. The NRC, the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence, actually just convened a housing innovation think tank just last week in Seattle, where we had the opportunity to bring together some folks around the country, some DV programs and allied programs around the country that appeared to be doing innovative housing work. We're using, and they're very different, we're using federal and other, you know, and state housing vouchers to create affordable housing or create access, greater access for domestic violence survivors, domestic and sexual violence survivors, because some of them are dual programs, so that they were responding to the broader set of issues. Building housing, literally creating housing, doing more coordinated housing advocacy. In one of the programs in Washington, D.C., had actually created a whole building for long-term housing, two years plus, with no barriers. In other words, there's no one gets screened out. The program has organized itself to be responsive to mental health, to substance abuse, to a range of issues that are often seen as too complicated for emergency shelters to respond to. So all I can say is that there's a lot of people trying to think about how to do this. There's no easy answer. Obviously there are so many communities where housing has just been priced out of everyone's reach, never mind somebody who landlords may be hesitant to rent to if they check the protection of our database or, you know, pull criminal records and, you know, engage in what is technically discriminatory behavior. So it's a very complex area. Again, we're trying to both learn from folks who have ventured, again, with interesting sets of partners and with some access to new funding streams into this area, and figure out, again, how to help other folks learn from these innovations that are occurring, again, in pockets of communities. But this was a problem 30 years ago where there wasn't affordable housing, and it remains a problem. So we're right there with you trying to understand how we can move our work forward to expand the options Some of them were actually, and I'll just disallow.
Thank you, Anne. I'm sorry, I'm having a little problem with static, which I think is my phone, but I hope I didn't cut you off because I'm having a hard time hearing. But if I'm wondering if maybe we can ask Sandra to comment on this question too, because I know you've had a lot of direct experience with that.
Sandra? Oh, it's a very complex issue. And I wish I had a magic wand and a box of answers for you. But I don't, and I think that those next calls will be very helpful. But I think that looking through strategies and looking through the policies and procedures on how the nonprofits organize and trying to find something within those policies that may be helpful for you and keep working towards educating those systems. But it's very complex, and it's, you know, really a challenge across the nation. And I wish I had better answers for you, but I'm kind of at a loss. But it's a challenge that we're all facing and chipping away at every single day.
And that we'll be doing together as we move through the rest of these calls. It's certainly been so stimulating to think about all that has been raised. And, Anne, you've raised some wonderful information for us, and we've gotten such great questions and participation from all of our programs today. Before we wrap up, Anne, I wonder if you can share with us your thoughts about, excuse me, where do you think we can go from here?
Well, I think you can learn as much as possible from the experiences, again, of the folks that you've invited onto your next calls, the Missouri Coalition. And the gift that they provided, I think, to all of us is that they were willing. First of all, they embarked on a thoughtful, collaborative project with the between the coalition and member programs. They gave it the time it needed, and they documented their process. So I think that there's a lot to learn, and they would be the first to say, "This is what we did in Missouri. You need to figure out what you need to do wherever you are." But they were very generous in sharing their experiences. I think Washington State also has, and they've one of their particular contributions has been how to think about how the physical design of our shelters or any kind of residential programs impacts the experience of survivors. So they're Building Dignity website, which if people haven't been on that, it's you can get to it through the Washington State Coalition website. But also I think if you do buildingdignity.org, you might get there as well. I mean, those are great resources. I think so that would be the first thing is just to learn from folks who have already gone here and discovered that while it was hard, the earth didn't fly into the sun. I think there's lots of reasons to be encouraged. And then I think we'll also look forward to continuing to learn from all of you as you go through these experiences and, you know, make changes and see what happens and continue to get feedback from survivors about what difference it makes. So, I just think continuing to engage in critical thinking, not be scared to go there, but, you know, go there thoughtfully and carefully and, again, taking advantage of the guidance that already exists.
All right. That's a very encouraging and helpful summary. Thank you, Anne. I wonder if Sandra or Beth or Diane or Priya, if you have any final thoughts that you'd like to leave our participants with today.
This is Beth. The only thing I think I would add to Anne's thoughts were to also open the conversation up wider than your usual net. And I think when I was hearing the comment that we received via email about the struggles that they're currently having with shelters, I would encourage you to invite them into these calls or have your own dialogue kind of facilitated in kind of the same way so that you can have open conversations with as many as possible. The more brains we have behind this, the better the outcome usually is. And, you know, most of what I found is that there aren't typically ill-intentioned rules. They all came from a good place. In thinking, and they may not have ended up in a good place, but sometimes it just takes us thinking through together and be gentle and kind to each other to say, what would this look like if we didn't have it, or what are our fears, what are our challenges around it? And once you start opening those cans of worms, then, you know, it all just starts pouring out, and then you can start solving it together. So,
very helpful reminder. Thank you, Beth. Sandra, Diane, Priya, any final thoughts for us?
This is Diane. I was just going to add to what Beth said and a reminder to all of us that we can also give it a try. So I think it's Melissa Skaya who's talked about, you know, we'll do this for 6 months and then we'll revisit it and see how it works, which I think can feel more comfortable sometimes to people.
Let survivors know you're doing that. I mean,
yeah, well, yeah.
Them in the process, right, to say, hey, we're looking at this and we'd love, yeah, I mean, yeah, I think that's a great idea. I mean, I think it's the right comment.
Diane, Sandra, or Priya?
Just every day is a new opportunity, and there's incredible advocates out there to reach out to, and just keep on doing the work.
Yeah.
Well, those are very encouraging words from all of you as we really mull over all the important issues that have been raised today and all the future conversations that we plan to have around this issue. Before we wrap up, I think Beth, you or Diane, one of you have some announcements for us?
I do have two lovely announcements. One is to remind people that we are going to continue this dialogue. If you haven't gotten that message already today, but we are going to continue talking on this topic two more times. The next date that you want to mark in your calendar is August 1st, and then the third of this series will be on September 5th. And then the next time we all come together collectively as three classes will be at our keynote lecture, which will take place on July 17th. So those are the three dates to mark in your calendar. Please remember your evaluations at the end of this call, and have a phenomenal day.
So I just can't thank you enough for all the important work that you're doing and the very thoughtful attention that you've brought to this, the issues of how we can look at shelter rules and look at our own work with survivors in the context of shelters to be able to have environments and work that really honor women and their experiences and move us forward in our social change advocacy. So thank you so much for being on this call today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you to all of our Fishbowl participants, and especially to our participants who emailed or called in with your thoughts or your questions. We hope that you'll keep thinking and keep identifying questions or thoughts or examples, and that you'll be a part of our dialogue together around these issues as we move forward. Thanks to everybody. This call is now over.